Short disclaimer. This podcast is in no way affiliated with the Stars production or Diana Gabaldon. All views expressed are solely our own. Welcome to the Outlander podcast,
where the men are kilted,
the women are winsome,
and the whiskey is neat.
Welcome to episode 76 of the Outlander podcast. I'm Ginger.
And I'm Summer, and we are in love with all things Outlander. So, announcements this week. It was announced that the Outlander stars will be live at the Paley Fest in Los Angeles on March 12th. Now, they don't specify which stars will be there or how many will be there, so I can't speak to that. But if you're in the LA area around March 12th, you can buy tickets. We also got a few new shots from the Outlander Stars Instagram account. An absolutely stunning shot of Katrina. Like, I don't know, just the lighting, like, it's just a really, really well-composed shot, that, and I totally want that cowl. And we also got one more behind-the-scenes shot. This one, we can see Matt B. Roberts, we can see Ron Moore, and Kate in that highly impractical white furred capelet thing that thought was really bad traveling. I would never want in that time period to have white fur, and I know I've said this before, but I stand by that. But another behind the scenes shot from Outlander Stars. Bear McCreary posted a picture on his Facebook account this week. It looks like his piano with a bunch of copies of the first volume of the soundtrack for season one of Outlander, which is coming out. Do you know the date? Is it March?
February 10th, girl.
I thought, okay, wait, I always do this because for what everything else was March.
What else is March?
The Paley Fest we just talked about was March. Okay. It was March. It was on my head. Anyway, I know it's pre-order available now, and it will be available in February.
The volume one of the DVD Blu-ray may be available in March. I know it's available for pre-order now, so maybe that's what you're getting it confused with.
That's probably it. I'm easily confused these days.
February 10th,
people. And I don't know. I'm really excited about it. I really want it. Can we get one?
I don't know if you can already buy it. I think it's still pre-order, but I know it will be available if it's not already available on iTunes. So do you want like a CD because it's so gorgeous? Nah. Or do you just want the music?
I just want the music.
Obviously, we want the music.
I'm so bad. I hate CDs. Like, I don't want anything physical anymore. Now that everything can be like in a cloud and saved, it's like having the hard copies is annoying.
I don't disagree. I love the ease with which you can just virtually hold things on any of your devices, but there's something about a case, and this is just, I mean, you'll still see the quote-unquote sheet in your music, it'll be the icon for the digital version, but there's just something about having that physical thing. It's something like this in the case.
I mean,
case. It's just really
I get
beautiful.
It. It's an old school thing. I know the people who still collect vinyl records just
I'm not even
they
talking
like,
about
no I know
just
the feel
the physical. I think this is beautiful.
I know it is, but there's a lot of people who want the physical tangible evidence of it. Like I know people who still like I don't buy books anymore. I know people who do. I don't buy physical books anymore. They're all in my Kindle. They're all saved somewhere so I can get them wherever I am, however I want them. But I know people who like swear by it. They're like, I can't read a book unless I can touch the pages or smell the smell of the paper. And I guess I'm just not that way. But I'm looking forward to it being released because I want to hear more music. I want to be able to play it. I've only got the one Bear McCreary song on my iPod right now, which is just Skyboat song. So I'm excited to add to that collection. It was announced this week by The Hollywood Reporter that Katrina will be joining George Clooney, Julia Roberts, in a new movie called Money Monster.
Yeah, that's so not a big deal.
Not a big deal.
Not at all.
I mean, it's a huge deal for George Clooney to be in such a great, you know, cast with Katrina.
That's not where I was going. Where I was going was, I mean, George Clooney, he's okay. I mean, Julia Roberts, I mean, she's been around for a little bit.
A little bit.
So is George Clooney. Just like for a few days.
He's been around since like the 80s.
I know. What was that show he was in?
Facts of Life.
Yes. I'm sorry.
With his gargantuan mullet.
That was a cute show.
It was a huge mullet. I mean, it wasn't like John Stamos mullet worthy from like Full House because that was an amazing mullet, but he did have a mullet. Also, it was announced this week that Knockout Licensing has established a lot of new licenses for the Sony Pictures television TV series Outlander, which means there's going to be a lot more merchandise coming down the pipeline, which is really exciting because I just don't have nearly enough Outlander stuff in my house.
And I think, as I said on probably Facebook and Twitter, no idea and no commitment to a certain number because we need to see what it is, number one, and how affordable it is, number two. But I kind of tease, I'm sorry, if it's some pretty great stuff, we may just have to do some more giveaways. So we'll see. That definitely is in the future. I mean, giveaways are in the future no matter what, but we'll have to see what these items are. I mean, I did read that there's like a car air freshener. I don't think that we'll be giving that away.
I think we absolutely should. What does it smell like? What does it smell like? Does it smell like heather? Does it smell like peat? Does it smell like whiskey? That's a terrible idea for an air freshener.
Whiskey?
Yeah, if you got pulled
peat?
Over. No.
Oh.
If you got pulled over and your car smelled like whiskey.
That officer, really, truly.
I promise
it's from this show.
Air freshener. Or just smells like
That's
dirty
funny.
Scotsman, like sweaty, musky Scotsman. I would buy that. And now on to our read-along. This week we are discussing chapter 15, entitled In Which Music Plays a Part. And I'm so thankful that the word mediation, meditation, any of those things were not in this title this week.
Oh, I thought you were going to say something else. I thought it was so... We knew that this would be the chapter we'd be discussing since last week because 15 comes after 14. But it is a huge, huge coincidence, or synchronicity, I should say, that the chapter on music is the same episode as our upcoming interview,
you know,
which you'll hear shortly.
It's like Stars listens to our podcast and says, how can we help them this week?
Oh, I don't know about that.
They don't. But it would be cool if they did.
So chapter 15 opens with us finding out that they did indeed find and use the other bottle of whiskey. Ellen G. writes, I don't know about you two, but when I was in college and I got a little tipsy, my brain would go into overdrive. So too did Jamie and Claire's brains after the second bottle and beginning of ciphering the codes. It really shows the depth of knowledge Jamie has in all things. Early in this chapter, and this is Ginger again, no longer Ellen. Early in this chapter, we learn more about the code of the letters that Fergus is borrowing. There is the reference to King James III, Manzetti, an Italian baker, whom Charles has borrowed 15,000 livres from. So James had given good advice, at least in that direction, in his letters. Jamie has Claire look at a letter, and she asks if it's in Polish. Like, that's something I'd probably say if I had no clue what it was. Jamie says no, it's in English, but it's a bad cipher. He says it's an easy one. Break the letters into groups of five, don't count Q or X. Sure, that's an easy thing to do, but to know to do it at the beginning?
I know, but that broke my head a little bit, because I was trying to, as I was reading it, I was like, I can't make that make sense to me, because not all words are five letters long.
Doesn't matter, you treat it as one long line, continuing line.
Okay.
Of letters, of garbledygook, basically.
So then why five? Why would you break it into five?
I have no idea. That's what this cipher calls for, whoever set it up.
Okay.
So do you think you'd also guess Polish, or like alien?
No, my thought initially was that it would probably, I would think it was something with a different alphabet altogether, something more like Cyrillic or something.
But they're using English letters.
Yeah, but she was saying there were some letters that were out of context.
But out of context doesn't mean they're not, I'm sorry, not English. Out of context doesn't mean they're not Roman letters, Roman script.
Maybe she should have thought it was Welsh then.
That's a good guess, depending on the accent stuff. How would you write in cipher if you had to?
Me?
No, the other person sitting across from me.
Hey,
Mr. Couch,
just,
what would you do?
I didn't know if that was like a rhetorical question or something that you
no,
were just kind of
I'm asking
out loud.
It is out loud, but okay. It's also for you.
I don't know. I've never felt the need to cipher anything. I mean, I would never do it in writing. Like, I do, we have like secret languages that I have with like a friend of mine, and then, you know, there's...
Habi Habu?
Yeah. That's not... That's going to sound so, like, bad. We have a secret language with a lot of B's in it.
Abi Abu.
Yeah.
But which I can't
she
speak.
She didn't even just say a word, by the way. That was.
I know. I made fun of the sound.
It's true.
So
there's
and
that.
It was actually pretty done pretty well.
Well, we have that. We have, like, there's, like, gibberish and because less people speak gibberish than speak Pig Latin. Most people could understand Pig Latin, but...
And gibberish, to me, is easier to form than Pig Latin, because Pig Latin, you got to turn things around. Until you know it, then you know it. But gibberish, to me, is easier to learn or teach.
But nowadays, I think I would just use...
Speak German.
Like, well, there's that. But not if I was in Germany, then everyone would know what I was talking about.
No, well, Summer, I'm just saying, if it was going to be
in writing, because nobody does handwriting anymore, everything's on computer and stuff like that, I guess I would probably just use one of the wingdings. The font. The wingding font.
And then have someone just save it and put it in a different font?
Yeah. They'd have to figure out which wingding. There's like
four
or five
of them now. So if you ever see a wingding, just choose Ariel and you'll get everything she's trying to tell you.
Now you know.
Which is...
Do, 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 do. The more you know.
Yeah, and that's not a good... Okay. I would choose
Invisible ink?
I would choose Invisible Ink. And, of course, this reminds me of the Cracker Jack boxes and the movie The Christmas Story.
Oh.
Or am I wrong? Isn't in that movie they have Cracker Jack boxes, right? And the treats or toys he gets. Aren't they trying to decipher? But it wasn't Invisible Ink. It was like
No, it was a ring.
Yeah, it was words he had to match with something.
Yeah, it was an ad. Like, he was so ticked off because there was a secret message he got off the radio. And he was like, I finally got this Little Orphan Annie cipher ring or decoder ring.
Oh, yeah.
And then he sets it up so it tells him which letters are which letters. And it ended up being like, something.
Oh,
he was like, what? He was very upset about it.
Jamie does his best to explain the code to Claire. Oh, you just do this, and then you take this, and then you see this. You get it? I would have been like, I need, go find me a third bottle of whiskey because
I'm obviously not there with you.
You're
yet.
Not. It's not working. We learned that the tone of James's letters overall tend one way, and the ciphered one spells it out clearly that James wants Charles to find favor with Louis, but that he isn't looking for support for an invasion of Scotland. James has no interest in seeking restoration to the throne. And this is, of course, King James, Charles' father, not our Jamie. Because this is all in the third person, trying to keep the people straight. There aren't that many people, but still. So what they're saying is that what the gist they get through the letters, the commonalities, is that King James, right, who's in Italy, who sent his son Charles to
France.
And that's what they're trying to figure out, what the purpose is or what's going on behind the scenes. What the evidence seems to point to is that James, according to what they found, he is not expressing an interest to be restored to the throne. So far, they can't, according to James, what they find in James's letters is that he is looking to help his son and have his son find favor with King Louis, but there isn't evidence thus far that we've seen that they presented to us of a restoration attempt thus far.
Well, that's what they're looking for, ultimately, is proof and the how that they are trying to accomplish this restoration event. I think
if it even exists.
Right. Well, they know it's going to happen. They're just trying to figure out how it's going to happen and how they can thwart it. That's the bottom line.
But they have to find out
absolutely
where it's coming from first.
Of course.
Jamie continues. James, King James, is canny. He doesn't have much money of his own. His wife did, but she left it to the church when she died. Philip of Spain and the previous King Louis, the Sun King, had given troops and ships to James to try to regain the throne, which had to have been the 1715 uprising. But it all went sideways. James didn't even make it to Scotland. Jamie thinks, what would he do? So instead of... Actually, you can use the WWJD. He would see one son established, given a military appointment, and men to lead, perhaps something like a general of France. Once James admits openly that the Stuarts will never rule again, he has no more value to Louis. That's interesting. That's a very good point. Without the possibility of an armed Jacobite invasion to occupy the English, Louis will have little reason to give Charles anything beyond what is decent.
Well, it's a power position. I mean, if you have somebody who has the potential to be a big
another
player,
sovereign.
you want to be in with them.
You want to be on their...
Right. You want to be somebody who helped them get there so they owe you something. But if he's never going to be a power player, why even bother? He's like, oh, he's a nobody. He's a pretender, which is what everyone called him anyway. So as long as he has that in his pocket as a possibility of something he's maybe trying to do or could do, he's of worth to other people.
Potential worth. Uh-huh.
Yes.
Though there wasn't a ton of evidence, the evidence that they did have all pointed in this general direction. What does this mean to you? And if Jamie's guess as to the Chevalier's motives was correct, then our task was accomplished already, had never in fact existed at all. And this is from Claire. That their mission to prevent a Jacobite uprising may not have existed at all, because it doesn't appear that James wanted that. That it was all to keep up appearances only to be sure that his son or sons would basically receive welfare from his cousin Louis. As long as the hint or possibility of a future uprising was there, there was reason for Louis to help his cousin. Now that makes sense. Sometimes I had to read through a few times just to make sure I was saying this correctly and I had it straight. Like sometimes my brain, I do better with dissonance.
Let's just talk paradoxes for a second. Because, and the time travel paradox. Because if they've gone back, and when they're in France, they find no proof of a planned uprising, what if their presence there, or her presence there, created it?
Then it still would have created it all along.
If she was part of the original timeline, that would have meant that she was always supposed to be there.
And that is how it is.
I know, but isn't that like blow your mind? Like the one thing that
she's... The TT always brings... TT always blows my mind.
Okay, you can't say TT because I know a lot of people that use the word TT to be an abbreviation for going to the bathroom.
What?
Yeah.
I thought it was this.
No, I got a TT.
I've never heard of that ever.
I'm just telling you. Let's not do that. Just say time
capital T, capital T. Sorry. It's from genetics. That's why I... And since in Diana's Outlander universe, it is linked to genetics... I can't separate the two. Anyway, capital T, capital T. Time travel in this whole thing, yes, it's mind-boggling, but...
Like, for real, think about it this way. What if, in the original timeline of life, Louise Dutour, or whatever, got rid of her baby?
Oh.
And gave Charles Stewart no reason to try, because his whole thing is he's like, I'm going to get my crown back, and then once I have my crown back, I'm going to force you to get a divorce, and then I'm going to claim that child as my own because it's mine.
Yeah, but he could have been full of words, though.
But he could have been. But what if Claire basically being that catalyst of, no, you can keep it, go do this, and then you can find a way to keep your baby. What if that was the catalyst for the whole thing?
Yeah.
What if her presence there actually made it happen?
Then it would have always made it happen.
Okay.
Listeners, let us know what you think. We love to hear from you any way and every way, but specifically about this, what do you think about time travel and the paradoxes? Do you think that because she went through and this happened, that it was always supposed to happen? That's one thing. And then what about Summer's question about what if Claire was that catalyst because of her conversation with Louise? That's different than the bathtub scrying, but it's just as interesting to look back at that conversation with Louise. So that's interesting.
Well, it just makes me think. I'm like, because one of the things that they mention, I think, in this chapter is his relationship with Louise being a catalyst for him. You know, well, when I get my throne back, I'm going to do this and I'm going to do that and then we can be together. And, you know, what if that was never an issue? What if that hadn't been an issue? And what if, you know, Claire being there and giving her another option was the catalyst to that? I don't know.
The next day, Claire goes on a few errands and then to L'Hôpital. When it's about time to go and neither Fergus nor Myrta have arrived to escort her home, she goes into Mother Hildegard's office to wait. Jamie shows up and is nearly ripped to shreds by Bouton.
I love this scene.
Me too.
Like, I love that he doesn't think in anyone's English. Watching him and the whole thing happens and
in
it's
English,
just...
In English, yeah.
And she's just in the shadows watching it happen and not, like, just letting it happen, not... telling him she's there or like calling Bouton off. She's literally just like, what's gonna happen?
Bouton.
Oh my God. I was so close.
You were. No, you're fine. Bouton is what I hear a lot. Jamie has a nice conversation with Bouton. The crowning glory, quote, you're the famous fellow that sniffs out sickness, no? Well then, why are they wasting you on silly things like door guarding when you might be making yourself useful smelling gouty toes and postulant arseholes?
Wow.
And every time, not every time, but in this episode, and this is saying something, previous episodes when I've tried to write arseholes, it comes out arseholds.
Holds?
Holds.
Is that a thing?
I don't know, but it keeps coming out.
I mean,
I type it. It's not a correction.
Is that like a noun, like a place where in an arse that you hold things?
That's enough. Okay. I just thought it was funny that was something that came out of my fingers. LNG writes, back at L'Hôpital, Bouton and Jamie. That Claire stayed in the background listening to Jamie speak with the dog was so funny. Jamie being so big and Bouton so small. And when Mother Hildegard comes in, Jamie and Claire continue to speak in English. And then Claire introduces Jamie to Mother, whom he has come to see. Mother Hildegard and Claire have a few words of observation before the former goes into the area. Claire appears, and Jamie is a little off-put by the idea that Claire has been listening to the conversation he had with the dog.
But my favorite part is when she's like, what exactly were you planning on doing when you had him wrapped in your kilt? And he's like, I was going to throw him out the window and run. And at one point I was like, oh, poor Bouton. But at the same time I'm like, no, that's about what you'd have to do.
And run, exactly. We learn that Jamie had not come to see Claire, but rather Mother Hildegard. They are all in Mother Hildegard's office, papers sprawled across her desk. He says that Herr Gerstmann recommended he consult the mother about them. He had brought sheets of music, quite literally sheet music. Jamie tells her that there is something odd about the music. Mother Hildegard says that she understands he has no key for music. Another joke. I wonder if Diana meant that. Jamie calls it his disability. Claire catches Mother Hildegard's throat working as though she were silently singing, and also, quote, one large foot twitched slightly, keeping time. This line brings a tear prick to my eyes, quote, at last she lowered the pages, peering at him over the tops. Her eyes were sparkling, and she looked suddenly like a young girl. This is probably one of the best chapters for us as far as Mother Hildegard goes. We find out, of course, so much about her. What do you think?
We did find out a lot about her. Now, she stated that the king was her godfather?
The old king.
The old king.
Yeah.
Which I thought was... The sun king. That, to me, came as a shock. And it made me wonder... I mean, obviously, I didn't wonder enough to go and actually research it. But that Mother Hildegard, perhaps, is like an actual honest-to-God character and not just one that she made up. Though anyone could have been anyone's godfather. I don't know. But that connection that Diana created made me go, wait... There's more to her than meets the eye. She's a transformer.
A transformer. So Mother Hildegard says that she thinks Jamie is right, that there is something odd there in the music. Jamie asks if she can discern a pattern in the music, and he explains that he thinks it may be a cipher, the language of the message in English, though the text is in German. The songs were sent from England. She asks if Claire could help her in the deciphering. So,
real quick, how disappointed were you? That they did not specify the German, that they didn't show the German of that conversation. Did you? Because
no.
It's like, I know she translated it and was like, the verdant hills and the shepherdess. Did you, were you, and they said it was bad German, where you're like, oh, I really wish that they'd posted what that German was.
No.
That surprises me.
I would have slowed down even more.
Do they have, I know they have like a term for like Anglophiles, like people who are like all into like British stuff. Do they have a term like that for people who are all into like German stuff?
I don't know. That evening, Claire stays with the sisters at the convent to work with Mother Hildegard. I love the description of her suite. The outer one, a furnished sitting room where she must receive visitors, is rather rich. The next one, which has a harpsichord and a few pieces of furniture, including a bookshelf, books on musicology and manuscripts. Claire gets paper and ink. The music was written with care across heavy parchment. The title, Lied des Landes. Mother Hildegard says that the title reflects something simple, like a Volkslied. But the form and composition reflect something different. Claire does some sight singing. The music has a basic melody and variations. Mother Hildegard says, such variations! You know, I have seen some things reminiscent of this by a little old German named Bach. He sends me things now and again. She says this variation, the one they are holding, is a, quote, clumsy imitation of one of his things. She has an idea, and then goes and gets some of her Bach pieces. She looks through them, and then brings out a piece called Goldberg Variations. Claire, quote, touched the paper with some awe, swallowed hard, and looked back at the lead. Can you imagine being someone from the 21st century and just going back? Just, this is like, you're already in the past where... history's like obviously painfully come to life.
You're in
and
it.
And here you are. Yeah, you
you're
are.
You're in it. You're part of it. And to have them be like, oh, this little known German composer, his name's Bach. No big deal.
LNG writes, I think it is interesting that DG has dropped the Goldberg variations into the story. I laughed when Mother Hildegard said, Herr Bach is not well known in France. I believe he had some small popularity in Germany and in Austria 15 or 20 years ago, but even there, his music is not performed much publicly. I'm afraid his music is not the sort to endure. Clever, but no heart. Mother was right. The paper had matched the piece by Bach. It was a copy, with the exception of a different note here and there. Mother notes that the song is repeated, but the key changes each time. You can tell the change in key signatures. The key changes apparently make no sense musically. She says, quote, not that one expects great poetry from Germans in general, but really, still. So the German lyrics were apparently not very impressive. Mother Hildegard, she had perhaps an eidetic memory. Her family is wealthy. Had she been a man, she says, she would have been a musician. She says that it is the fault of Saint Anselm. Her godfather, the old Sun King, had given her a book of the Lives of Saints for her own Saint's Day when she was 8. And one phrase in the story of Saint Anselm stuck with her. She says, Saint Anselm was a man of great wisdom and great learning, a doctor of the church, but also a bishop, a man who cared for the people of his flock, and looked after their temporal needs as well as those of the spirit. His story ended with, quote, and so he died at the conclusion of an eminently useful life and thus obtained his crown in paradise. An eminently useful life appealed to her. Ellen G. writes, we learn more about Mother Hildegard, her family ties, her musical ability. I think she trusts Claire with all of this, and since she is nobility, she feels a kinship with Claire.
I think she also recognizes the fact that they are trusting her with something, and it's like a shared moment of trust. Like, you're trusting me with this, and I'm going to trust you with my secrets and things about me that I don't share with other people.
So the change in key signatures is odd. Claire has an epiphany. Her thinking in English had helped her realize that the change in the key was what was important, or the key to the cipher. The message would be in English. The German text only provided the source of letters. I love this line. You have got ink on your nose, says Mother Hildegard, and then goes back to the cipher. Does that make sense? It's just like so random, like... You have something right there. Okay. Oh, back to what we were doing. It was just so random. I just loved it. It was so random. The code says basically that the loyal English subjects await his arrival on English soil with the sum of £50,000. They have a little snack. Mother plays for Claire, quote, to help compose her mind for sleep. When Claire asks if the piece was her own, she says no, a friend's. Jean-Philippe Rameau. I mean, she's got some great friends. Another famous composer. So the cipher is the first definite sign that the Stuarts are actually making an effort at a restoration attempt. They think it's possible Charles is acting on his own, that James has set him up, but Charles isn't pretending. Mm-mm. Jamie is shaving, back at the ranch. Jamie is shaving and Claire asks him if he's ever had a beard. He says yes, he has, but it itches and he's not really a fan of itchiness. Jamie compares himself to an orangutan when he has a beard.
But I love the fact that she's like, so it's not okay if I shave my extra bits, but if you shave your face, that's totally cool.
But he says, no, it actually isn't necessarily that cool, but he's itchy when he doesn't do it.
No, but she made a really good point.
LNG writes, Jamie with a beard. And we are seeing Sam grow one, maybe for the movie he's filming soon. And the way Jamie tells Claire what he looks like, a big orangutan with the red beard.
Well, the pictures I've seen, it doesn't look like he's necessarily growing a beard. Like, it's not getting super long. It's kind of maintaining at that kind of grow out stage, which is what he would be wearing in when they're living wild. Mm-hmm. And I think that once they're not living wild, and when he's in France, he's completely clean shaven because he has the opportunity and the things at hand that he would need to maintain that.
So they now must be on even more of a lookout. Claire asks if Charles buys his wine from him and Jared out of patriotism, or is he also a customer of Silas Hawkins? So is that our first hint that Hawkins may be an English Jacobite?
I mean, it's definitely possible.
So this was not only an entertaining chapter, it was Interesting because of the whole cipher. Also interesting because of all of the different ramifications. I mean, we learned about how to use music to spread your secrets, how to cipher clumps of five letters. I mean, avoid X's and Q's.
Well, I mean, I don't know if I learned how. I mean, it was like, it was kind of glossed over. I don't think that I could look at a cipher and break it into five and know what I was doing, but.
Oh, never.
But I feel like we kind of got the rudimentary, like, okay, here's how you might start. But we're not going to tell you exactly how to do it, but here's one way that might be helpful in your journey towards ciphering out your secret manuscript.
But it was the chapter kind of had a, it was like all around. I mean, it talked about ciphering, it talked about potential Jacobites, what the plan is or plan isn't, potential plan is or isn't, and then, of course, a ton about Mother Hildegard. So that was a nice chapter.
Like, for real, I'm really excited to see who they cast as Mother Hildegard. And I still in my head, and I know you didn't agree with me, but I totally see Maggie Smith.
It's not that I disagree with her. She's a great actress. She would be awesome. But she's not a scarecrow.
I guess.
She would do the role. She would do the role just fine. She would be awesome. I can't describe whom I see as Mother Hildegard because I see what Dana describes. And it's very general, I guess, but I don't see a person.
Well, stars, if you're listening.
Or an actor.
And I don't think you are. But if you are, I really think Maggie Smith would be amazing in this. And if she could take a break from Downton Abbey and come on board to play Mother Hildegard for season two, that would be so awesome. And that was chapter 15. Next week, we shall be discussing chapter 16, The Nature of Sulfur. And now we have a special treat. We had an opportunity to interview Bear McCreary. And I say we because we as the podcast did, but I unfortunately was unable to be there. And I handed the reins to the very, very capable Ginger to handle this because she is a giant music nerd. And I think you can tell from this interview that they kind of geeked out together and it was kind of made of awesome.
It was nice. I'm not going to lie. But it was just, so I'm not going to lie, I was very excited. I was a little bit nervous. I don't know if you'll be able to hear it in my voice because we also wanted to get our questions in our blessed period of time that we had. So it was fun. It was kind of cool.
So without further ado, here is our interview with Bear McCreary.
Hello.
Hello.
Yes. Hi there.
Hi.
Welcome, Mr. McCreary. Thank you so much for making time to speak with us today.
Of course. This is going to be fun.
It always is. We love reading your blog, hearing you at events, anything and everywhere, and of course your music. We are all excited about the release of Volume 1 of Season 1's soundtrack on February 10th. Will there be any bonus tracks on this release, like a taste of the second half, or deleted score items, extended themes, etc.?
On this first album, there's not going to be any bonus material because I have been saving some material for the second half. I actually found that there is so much material from even the first eight episodes that it filled an album entirely. And so I'm actually very excited that Sony and my record label have collaborated to do something for me very unorthodox, which is putting out a soundtrack album while the show is still airing and in production. I actually haven't even finished the second eight episodes yet, so it's very exciting to put out this sort of work in progress. And I think it's a testament to the passion that Outlander fans have for this show that Sony saw it right away and contacted me, and they knew that we needed to put something out as soon as possible.
Well, and we are definitely benefiting from that and very blessed that absolutely Sony and everybody aboard everyone is looking in the same direction. We're always interested in the creative process of musicians and artists. Do you hear the melodies once you're inspired in your head, or how does it work for you when you sit down to write?
That's a very difficult question to answer, but a great question. It's a very intimate experience for me. I sometimes will hear melodies in advance, but most of the time I hear shapes. It sounds kind of weird, I know, but I hear chord progressions, and I almost hear the I were to use an architectural term, the scaffolding, I know what the shape of the music is going to be, but I don't necessarily know the exact notes and the melody. I have to chip away at it and kind of find it. So sometimes I feel like a painter where I envision something and I paint it, but more often I feel like a sculptor where I have a slab of marble that's a certain size and I know my basic proportions, and as I chisel away and get into the finer and finer detail, later in the process I will find that melody and then I've got it.
It sounds like a little bit of synesthesia.
A little bit, yeah. Or synesthesia is in reverse. I take shapes and translate them into music.
Mm.
I must say that I'm very instinctual when it comes to watching the scene and hearing the shape of the music. I know what I want it to do, but I'm not necessarily immediate when it comes to melody. I think melody is something that I spend a lot of time working on. I put a lot of effort into, and I'm not ashamed to admit that it's not something that comes immediately to me. It takes a little effort to come up with a good melody.
As a fellow music major, and I was not a composition major, I was a voice major, I can completely respect that through my theory classes as well. Other than the Sky Boat song, are there any favorite pieces of music that you hope to work into episodes?
Yeah, I actually have a rich tapestry of themes that I've both collected and written for Outlander.
So, wow.
Some of them are Scottish folk songs. You already mentioned the Sky Boat song is a big one. And a number of tracks on the upcoming soundtrack are actually going to be my arrangement of traditional Scottish folk songs that I used in montages and important sequences. But then also there's the character themes that I wrote. And I think the one that audiences are probably most keyed into at this point is the Claire and Janie. That is one that is an original composition of my own. And you're going to hear it all throughout the record. I think that's probably the theme you hear more often than anything else, for obvious reasons.
So actually, you have helped me segue. I didn't have to do any segue. Thank you. Have you already begun to be inspired for Bree and Roger's theme? Or is that something that you wait until you see them cast? And if so, what about other characters?
Well, it's very helpful to see the actor. I mean, you're right. When a character is cast, you start getting a sense of what that person is. But also, I'm very inspired by the visuals, right? So I'm definitely thinking about season two. But most predominantly, I'm still working in season one. I'm working on the end of season one right now. So I'm very focused, singularly focused on getting to the end of that story. I'm working on the last episode right now, and so I'm focused on giving the first season a sense of musical cohesion and thematic unity. Once that's done, it's going to be fun to start looking ahead.
Are you looking, you may have already answered this question, if you haven't started research yet, do you have at least plans to, looking at music from the eras of season two, which would be 1960s, 18th century Scotland, again, as well as 18th century French court?
Absolutely. I am a research junkie. So every time I take on a new project, I spend a lot of time researching any instrumentation or music or historical music that would be appropriate to that. And that's one of the great joys of working on Outlander, is that that is a never-ending process. So I am very excited about looking for opportunities to incorporate music from those times and regions.
You mentioned that you're now near or on the final episode for season one, working on that. Knowing what we've heard, well, knowing from having read the book, having heard some of the actors and, of course, Diana speak of the very, you know, the difficult subject matter in those last few episodes, how are you affected by things like that and having the music reflect? Do you try and bring in hope, or do you try and reflect the actions on the screen?
That is also an excellent question. All right, I'm first of all, a disclaimer. Just in case anyone's listening that hasn't read the book, I'm still just going to avoid spoilers, but we all
okay.
know what I'm talking about. So, with regard to the tail end of the season, the show goes to some very dark places, and I find that Ron Moore as a producer and writer for television, he's a master at creating very deep and rich worlds. And that's one of the reasons I think he was the perfect fit for Outlander. So what he has crafted for the end is so dark and so bleak that it really was difficult and has been difficult for me to score it, not because it's difficult creatively, it's incredibly inspiring, but because just living in that world for days and days and days, you know, some of these scenes in question, when you watch them, they'll be 3 minutes or 5 minutes long, and you're looking at 8 hours of my day spent going over every frame and trying to augment that feeling. So that's one of the things that I find most rewarding, but it is a challenge for sure, because I'm a bit like a method actor, I think. I can't just intellectually write music that I know will be upsetting. I have to feel those emotions. So I have to be upset. I have to feel that darkness and sadness. So it's been a real roller coaster for me, and an incredibly rewarding one. But yeah, I didn't add hope. I think I want to take us to that place. There are places where there is a little bit of hope, but I think, you know, you're going to find that I'm really augmenting the story that Ron is telling. So I usually try not to let the audience off the hook in a scene like that.
I, for one, am glad to hear that, but I hope others will as well. Do you...
Well, let's do this again after the episode. I'll go through it scene by scene with you.
Oh, that would be... that. Of course, we would love that. How do you like to use dissonance?
Ooh, good question. Dissonance... You are a music major.
Sorry.
Dissonance is a composer's most powerful tool. To me, the fundamentals of dissonance is what makes music exciting, because it's the resolution from dissonance to consonant that ultimately provides satisfaction. What I'm talking about is like the most kind of fundamental function of what music does. So for people that aren't music majors, let me clarify real quick. Dissonance is where you hear a sense of clashing, a sense of conflict in the harmonies. And there's actually a mathematical reason for this, and I encourage you to check out, I co-wrote a chapter in a book called Hollywood Chemistry. It came out last year. I actually wrote basically a thesis on this and how it applies to film music, and I co-wrote it with Kevin Grazer, who's the science advisor on Battlestar. And it's interesting, because we actually realize there's a lot of math behind this, and the ratios of the sound waves are very complex ratios in consonant harmonies and very simple ratios in, I'm sorry, they're complex in dissonant harmonies, and they're simple ratios in consonant harmonies, which means your ear wants to hear consonants. So, all of that is a preamble. What does that mean? It means when I watch a scene, lines of dialogue give me triggers. When somebody turns their head, when somebody steps forward, when somebody says something revelatory. Basically, going back to that architecture that I was telling you about earlier, I hear consonant, dissonance. That's going to be, that's consonant, that's dissonant. Oh, that's going to be more dissonant. That's going to resolve. That is what lays out my roadmap. And actually, once I laid that out, the harmonies and whether they sound clashy or beautiful or mysterious, that's sort of the easy part. It's actually, there's a little bit of a science behind it. I don't want to say it's all science. Obviously, it's scoring narrative is emotion. But there's definitely a way to think about it that the answers are all there. The answers in a well-produced, well-edited piece of drama. The actors and the writing and the directing, they've done a huge amount of the work for you already, because those shifts from consonance to dissonance are going to be obvious. That's probably a much deeper answer than you wanted.
How has fatherhood affected your music?
Oh, my gosh. Good question. It has affected my music in a number of ways. Becoming a father has definitely made me think about my time a little differently. So I used to hammer away. way of things for 15 to 18 hours a day, and now I'm down to like 14 or 15 hours. But it really has affected the time I want to get out in the studio and spend time with my daughter. And I start thinking about crazy things, like what kind of world are we making for our children? And it just makes me appreciate my art even more. It makes me appreciate a show like Outlander, which I think really is saying something of value. It teaches us about the world, and it teaches us how to look at the world in a different way. And it's interesting with that really being at the forefront of my mind, because I think in a way I'm just starting to write music for my daughter, even when it's not on my mind, even when I'm writing for a TV show, I'm still thinking about her and the kind of music I want to create for her. So it's definitely had an impact in a subtle way, but across everything I do.
Thank you so much, Mr. McCreary. It has been an absolute pleasure to speak with you, and we hope to one day have that blessing again. Have a wonderful day, and we can't wait to hear more.
Thanks so much. Take care.
Thank you. You too.
So for real, this was like our
How
second
cool
time.
How cool was that?
I know, this was like our second time interacting with Bear McCreary, and both times, what I've taken away from it was just how seriously, like, jazzed he is about music. You know what I mean? It's like he's so into it, and it's so, you can see that he is so in the right business, and he's right in the place where he was supposed to be. Like,
he would make, and I'm sure, well, I can't say I know for a fact he's done this, but if he ever did, in some capacity, did some kind of teaching or, you know, the whole give back thing, he would make a fantastic teacher to youth, to anyone who's interested in learning from him, but he would make a great teacher to youth, like, you know, under 18, because he's so animated and excited.
He's so passionate about it. And I think that what's so key with any teacher in that regard is that I think that passion is infectious. And if you have somebody who's super excited about what they do, regardless of whether or not it's something you're interested in, you're excited about it.
Mm-hmm.
Like, I don't give a rat's about football. And I know that it's like Super Bowl day and everyone's super excited about it. I'm totally ambivalent to it.
But so does that mean if I go out, I have to do an errand, it's a good day to go? Because the cars will be gone.
Yes. But my point is if somebody came at me and was talking to me about football and how they were so excited about it and could articulate the way that Bear does how they feel about football and what it means to them, I probably would get a little excited with them. But I haven't met anyone like that yet. But it could totally happen. So that was episode 76. It was a big one, you guys. Lots of music. I hope you like music.
We had a great time. It was magnificent being able to speak with Bear, of course, again. And what a treat. And how giving and gracious he is, and he's just, again, as Summer said, so infectious.
But for real, if he ever has, like, 30 minutes that he could set aside, I mean, we could pick his brain for hours. Like, he's that kind of a conversationalist that he's super exciting to talk to.
Almost about anything, but especially, obviously, Outlander stuff. So, yeah, so thank you so much for joining us, and we can't promise anything as spectacular as this week for next week, but please do come back next week for our next episode.
Visit our website at www.outlanderpod.com. Follow us on Twitter at @OutlanderPod. Find us on Facebook at facebook.com/OutlanderPod. Or email us at outlanderpod@gmail.com.
I dreamt it last night.